And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey, you guys. Happy day that ends in Y.
Happy day. Happy drop day if you're listening on Tuesday.
My goodness.
Happy 24th if you're listening on drop day.
Oh, my.
Happy, I don't know. You're alive, so...
We're happy to be here. Yeah, we're happy to have you here, and we love you, and we're giving you cute little nose boops.
Boop.
And we sit here as we record. We just feasted. And now we have just spent some time talking about the Karen Reed trial. As we sit here and record, the verdict has just been released hours ago.
Hours. Breaking news.
Breaking news. She was acquitted of the, what I would call the important charges.
She was acquitted of the ones that I truly believe she should have been acquitted on.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, obviously, is driving under the influence a big deal? Absolutely. But I don't think anybody really disagreed on that. She kind of did say it. She was like, yeah, no, we all drink, and then we all drove home. Like, that was pretty cut and dry. I don't think anybody was going to say she didn't do that. Of course she did that. Look at her blood results.
Yeah.
We know she did that. It was the other things.
Yeah. And I will say... You know, like her or not, and almost especially because she's not super liked, it is so huge and important that we were able to come back with that. No, the evidence didn't really point to it. And you don't have to like her to say that she didn't kill someone.
And, you know, if you think of the taxpayers, which I know who wants to think of that, but really, all of that money that it took to prosecute her, not once, but two times.
Yeah.
Hundreds of millions probably.
Yeah. Well, and then on the exact make and model of her car for them to test with.
To purchase it. To
fuck around with it.
For all the expert witnesses, for all of the manpower that went into this.
For whatever that guy is, no offense, but full offense that it's taking 17 years to get a bachelor's degree he's still not done with. I'm assuming that's on a tuition reimbursement, no?
That is... I almost fell out of my chair when I heard that. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? He was like, and you still don't have it, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And you've been working on this since 2002? That's correct.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, what? Was it 17? Yes. It was something outlandish. I was like, what are we doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of the people following that case were in diapers when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
When he started his degree.
Yeah.
Sir.
Yeah,
I'm all for going at your own pace, but you cannot pretend to be an expert on something.
No. Well, and if we think right, like a typical bachelor's is 4 years with eight classes a year.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That he's spending a lot of time. That's 32 years. If he's doing one class per annual year, he's almost there.
Mm-hmm. He's over the hump when you think of it.
Yeah, he's only got two more years left if he's doing it that way.
And I want to say, we won't get into the whole trial right now, obviously. That's not what we're talking about today. But I will say that there was something really funny about, you know, do I think you need to have a degree to know your shit? Abso-fucking-lutely not. But if it's on your resume and part of the reason you got your job is because you said that I have put in this work and I have X amount of credit hours and this thing. Like, I've done the thing. I have the piece of paper and you don't have it. And then that workplace that's certifying you as an expert in this field didn't even confirm that you do have it. And then while you're testifying as it's live broadcast to hundreds of thousands of people, they remove you from their expert list because they went, oh, shit. Like, that's where I have the... That's...
Yeah.
And did the state, they didn't, the prosecutor, I mean, with all that manpower and all the money that you were spending, you didn't make sure that the expert witness you were calling was an expert?
Can I just one more time use this as a call to action to Google people?
Yeah.
Google. Because you know what? I've had friends go on dates with a guy they met on Hinge, and I know his DUI history in 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I know when he got Dean's List in college, those two semesters in the middle. And I know exactly where he's worked for the last 10 years because I just type it into Google.
Which is concerning. But it does tell your friend why he took an Uber
Yeah.
to their date.
Yes, it does.
Doesn't it? And it's really the more you know.
It is the more you know. It's really reading Rainbow in that way.
Yeah. Oh, you know? Rainbow. Is that I heard from a little birdie that this case is very gay.
Oh my God, it is.
So do we want to jump into our case today?
Listen, I'm happy to jump into it. Are we ready? Is there anything else we need to yap about, chat about?
I'm very excited for this case, so I don't think so.
Okay. Well, me too. So, yoo-hoo, pod's on. Hi, hello, and welcome back to About Time for True Crime, your favorite true crime podcast.
You guys.
If you like what you hear, please remember to follow, leave a review, a comment, and a 5-star review anywhere you listen. It helps us out so much.
So much more than you think.
So much, and we love it, and we love you, and we want to read all of your thoughts all the time, always. So jot that down. Today, I'm coming at you with, sadly, our last episode of Pride Month 2025. A big womp womp. And I would be remiss to not take any opportunity to share some of my culture mixed with some of our true crime culture to our podcast whenever appropriate. And dare I say, it's appropriate. As many long-term stands know, I fall happily on the rainbow spectrum, if you will. And as a little background to today's episode, I'm going to share with you a little rant on a long-term passion and an annual fixation that led to this episode. See, I love the arts. I've danced, I've learned multiple instruments, acted, and one of my very best and oldest friends, Randall, is a fashion designer whom I love very much and I'm always thinking of this time of year. As you may imagine, fashion is somewhat of a part-time passion for me, but in the time I spend on it, I always understand immediately why it's some people's entire lives. Anytime I step foot into the world of fashion, I'm reminded why artistic expression in daily lives is pertinent to humanity in ourselves. To gain the confidence in your own skin, to make a statement you want to the world, and also just like the joy that comes from a great pair of shoes.
It's true.
Fashion is a form of culture, a personal representation, and an artistic expression with which you don't have to say a word and immediately someone knows something about you. Think your clothes don't? Well, the people who are looking at fashion know that, and now they know that about you. And clothes are an expression of status, wealth, trends, and personality traits. Whether you know the difference between Louis Vuitton or Louboutins, you've likely heard of Versace. Which is where the rainbow piece comes in today. Because today we are talking about Gianni Versace, or Gianni, if you will. But I won't, because I don't talk like that and it feels kind of weird to say it like that every time. But Gianni Versace was the original designer of the House of Versace and one of what I will call the ultimate gay icons. You may not know Gianni by name, but you've probably heard of Versace. The same way you know Elton John, RuPaul, Lady Gaga, Freddie Mercury, and the like. Often, artists and expressives overlap with the queer community, and this is speculation and not science-driven. But I thoroughly believe that art is often a much easier way to express how we feel than words. And residing in a community that's often hated for a way that we were just innately designed, often fearing violence if outed to the wrong crowd, family members that could disown you, threats of conversion camps, political persecution, and more, it's understandable how the arts are sometimes preferable to words. Thanks to non-artistic icons like Martha P. Johnson, who pioneered the LGBTQ rights campaign in the 60s and 70s, who also later ended up murdered, but that's not what today is about, I have the ability to get married. And while I live in one of the safest parts of the United States, I still wouldn't hold my partner's hand if I'm outside. I would prioritize our safety over PDA. And with a happy Pride to all, I'd love to remind everyone that the first Pride was technically a riot after the Stonewall Raid in 1968. While it's hard to feel safe and out with pride, it's because other people were killed, murdered, ostracized, and isolated despite keeping love behind closed doors. And while there's a long history of LGBTQ plus violence, crime, death, and murder, I mean, hell, I literally haven't even touched on Dahmer, you guys. Today, we're zooming in on the fashion scene in the 90s. before learning about a serial killer that I'd never heard of in the true crime world. A serial killer.
Yeah, I am. You guys, you know when we do these cases that we don't actually know what the other one is talking about, but she did tell me because she was so giddy as soon as she got here. She's like, it's gay and it's Versace. And I was like, okay.
You were like, okay.
And there's this, and she's like, and there's a serial killer. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
So I am also in the dark as someone who I feel like is pretty well read on true crime.
Yeah, I mean, we have a podcast on it.
We kind of do. So I'm
with like a lot of episodes.
A little ashamed to say that I've never heard of this, but for some reason it hasn't come up. Like I thought when you were like, ooh, fashion, I was like, oh, the Gucci thing? Like, is that where we're going? I know nothing about this. I am not the whole know the difference between Louis Vuitton and
Louis Vuitton and Louboutin.
I wouldn't even know what I'm looking at if you showed it to me.
Oh.
I like TJ Maxx.
We gotta watch Sex in the City.
We should do that.
Okay. That's beside the point, but we absolutely should.
If you're looking for me, you're going to find me at TJ Maxx.
Yeah.
I'm like a little ad for them.
The Nordstrom rack.
Yeah.
Or a thrift store. It's one of the...
Love a thrift.
It's a real 0 to 100 for me. There's not a lot of middle ground.
Yes, exactly. Is that how I want to spend my money? No, but I would love to watch other people do it.
I love them. So, for the sources I've used, just to list it off the top per the usual, I used The Times, 48 Hours, the FBI Vault, News Cafe, Vogue, Vanity Fair. Ugh, I've used so many things. But for trigger warnings today, we are talking about mental health, violence, general queer history, which is like kind of terrible and dark and AIDS ridden. And we are talking about suicide. Also, a little bit of substance use, but it doesn't come up a whole lot. Also, you know, murder. But that, I feel like you knew that.
That too, yeah.
But, you know, I'm not going to tell you what you knew, you know. Also, I don't typically add a preface like this, but for today, a lot of the context I'm providing does include some of those historical moments in, like, gay rights liberation and all of that. And read the whole AIDS thing. Some of it's dark. So if it's not your thing, we'll see you next week. But if it is, strap in, babe. We got a ride. So we're going to start in 1997. Mm-hmm. We're in the fashion world. And the 90s are a time to be alive. I mean, we had the stock market crash of 1989 and the upcoming fear of Y2K, because apparently everyone thought we were dying. I guess 2000 called 2012 and asked for its torture back. I don't know. But there was the rise of electronics and a culture of people that had no clue what was really about to happen. So fashion, being the expression and sort of escapism that it is, really started mixing nostalgia, minimalism, and fantasy to escape the reality of the unknown and also the crippling economic situation that we were in. Also in the 90s came the era of the supermodel. Think Naomi Campbell, Cindy Crawford, Janice Smith, I mean, hell, Kate Moss. Like, if the 80s were twiggy thin, the 90s were dedicated to the women who could do it all and make you forget about it all at the same time. Fashion names still included Calvin Klein, Prada, Armani, and more, but even a broad scope in the 90s fashion trends by Vogue lists Versace as number one. Gianni Versace ran the Versace business with his sister Donatella, which, if you've heard of Lady Gaga, I am begging you to listen to Donatella because it's been stuck in my head all week researching this case. And every time I'm like done, I'm like, Donatella!
There Do what? Go.
Oh, you heard it. But he also worked with his brother Santo. The Versace family was native to a small town in Italy called Reggio Calabria, which had been left relatively devastated after World War II. Francesca, Gianni's mother, was a dressmaker for the town, which, as you may imagine, wasn't a particularly high-earning job in, like, post-World War II Italy.
Yeah.
But did allow Gianni to spend his childhood playing in design rooms and learning tricks to the trade. But unlike his mother, Francesca, he was a man of sophistication. And he was a wee bit too sophisticated for anybody in small town Calabria, Italy.
Yeah.
He did take a break for a little bit, and he ended up going to school for architecture, shortly. But mostly he was just buying time, hoping to land himself in Milan or Paris, anywhere that might open up an actual market for the clothing he wanted to make and sell. One interview I saw described him as, quote unquote, having an extra gear, because he just never slowed down. He would work and create until he passed out, and then he'd create some more. Eventually, Gianni did create a name for himself. Donatella, Santo, and Gianni had dreams of opening up one of the first Italian family-owned fashion businesses to be on the stock market in America.
Represent.
Santo, who ran much of the economic part of the business, seemed to always be kind of watching the magic of Donatella and Gianni, sort of like circling each other. I mean, he had a very active role in making these dreams a reality, but these two are like the sun and the moon, literally. Mm-hmm. If Gianni was the artist, Donatella was the face. Never a partier, rarely drinking, and never touching drugs, Gianni was a man who wanted to go home at the end of the runway. After all, Gianni met his life partner, Antonio D'Amico, in the 80s, who he was with until his death in 1997. And he was always more than a little happy to go home at the end of the night and get in bed early.
Oh, king.
Relatable. I can't say that Donatella loved being out, although she did eventually go to rehab years later. But being half of the marketing, Donatella was always out meeting new people, helping with interviews, doing publicity, schmoozing with the latest photographers, designers, and artists that could help make their dreams materialize. After all, the Versace brand had decades-long work with supermodels, sent beloved dresses to Princess Diana.
Oh.
They were close with Elton John, and even sent multiple gowns as essentially marketing to unrelated celebrities like Winona Ryder.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Versace knew marketing, and because of it, the world knew Versace. As business boomed, Gianni bought properties, expanded the company, and had a lavish lifestyle where Gianni and Antonio delighted spoiling their little niece Allegra.
Oh, could you imagine being her?
Oh, no. I think about it often.
You'd never buy clothes in your life.
No, your mother's Donatella Versace, which I think would have so much packed into that one statement. But like,
yes.
Insane. So they were incredibly close, and Gianni and Antonio just like loved. They'd be like, we'll go out shopping for the day. Like, we'll just have a little us time. And it's so cute.
So, and that's him and his partner?
Yes.
I feel like that's got to be like the benefit of, like, you just get to take your family members out. Like, you get to have all the fun uncle times, yeah, and like go shopping and do the fun things. And then when they act up, you send them home to mom.
I think that would be the case, but I do think they all like lived together most of the time while they were here.
Yeah, but send her to mom. Like, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, you don't have to do the parenting part. You get to be part of like the growth and the development and like those other really important parts without needing to be the scolder.
Yes, true.
Love that for them.
Gianni and Antonio also ended up buying and restoring an old chateau in South Beach, Florida, which was an incredibly safe place to be gay in the 90s. Who would have thunk? South Beach, say ally. And while Gianni may have been protected on runway events, in publicity, and overseas during fashion weeks, at home he liked to simply just be. So he never had a bodyguard out with him in South Beach. He'd literally just walk around. His neighbors knew he lived there. He just was.
I mean, maybe it's different community to community, but if I were anywhere and like a very famous designer walked by me, no matter what they're wearing, I'm certainly not going to know you by face.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if maybe in the community he lived in, if it's like very high fashion, like it's a lot of people, a lot of designers go there, a lot of people that know a lot of that stuff go there. I could see you being clocked.
Yeah. I think in general, like anytime someone's like buying and restoring an old chateau, you at least know there's money there.
Oh, yeah. But
you might not know what for, though.
Walking around and you don't see that, yeah, I'd be like, I have no idea. Like, you're very well dressed, but yes, okay.
He's just like a down to earth guy who has impeccable taste.
I love that.
And like the cutest little mole. Ugh, love it. But he loved to walk around. Every morning he'd go to like a little newsstand and get the magazines that were released that day to keep his finger on the pulse, if you will, and a coffee. And usually he'd do this with Antonio.
Hmm.
In July of 1997, Gianni was just returning home after what would be his last runway show in Paris. South Beach was a happening place. A little reminder here that when we talk about the 90s, we are by no means at all out of the AIDS epidemic. A continuing epidemic through today in many other nations, the United States didn't see a dramatic decline in AIDS deaths until 1996 with the newest medications called HAART, which is an acronym for a lot of medical words that are hard to say and look important, and you can look them up if you're really interested. Okay. So in 1997, this panic was by no means over. In 96, they just started seeing a decline in deaths.
Yes.
Not even diagnoses, not even HIV diagnoses. Like, mm-hmm. We're still talking advanced into AIDS.
Right.
So for context, by 1995, 1 in 9 gay men had been diagnosed with AIDS. Not HIV, AIDS.
Ugh.
And 1 in 15 had died from AIDS. In 10 years, just about, AIDS had killed 325,000 men and women in the USA in less than 10 years. And while we know more now that it's further into history, this is in part due to the silence and political pushback of the time, because it was essentially deemed a gay disease, and it was frequently looked, I mean, gayness as a whole was frequently looked at as immoral. And so it wasn't actually even talked about until about 5 years after it started. If you think about COVID,
mm-hmm.
That means the epidemic would have started 5 years ago and we would have just started talking about it today. Just for context.
Well, good thing AIDS isn't airborne.
We love that. And while it's not just due to homosexuality, obviously it's a sexually transmitted disease. Not a gay transmitted disease. This did disproportionately impact queer men, especially at the beginning of this crisis. So to say that South Beach was a happening place was actually an incredible understatement. To have a space that culturally and politically appeared to be open and safe for queer people to be, without fear of political retaliation for what was going on at the time, was huge. Not to mention that the AIDS epidemic was at its peak during that year and wiped out huge percentages of populations. To name a few, it included 61% of all deaths of men aged 25 to 44 in San Francisco, 35% in New York, 51% in Fort Lauderdale, 32% in Boston, and so many more.
Wow.
There are older gay men that talk about coming back into the world and calling it a literal ghost town. They lose entire friend groups.
Ugh.
And then you just have to get back out there. So the fact that not only was it safe to be out, but that there were in fact enough people to have a whole queer scene in Florida is like fucking miraculous. On top of this, Versace being in Florida had aided in putting Miami on the map for the fashion scene and other arts. So now it's like booming. It's also always warm. So I just picture a place with I'll be realistic, more than one single gay club that had actual people in it where they weren't all terrified of being in public and dressed real cute. It's warm. They're probably in convertibles, right? Or on little roller skates. Oh, that's so gay. I love it. Probably. And they're out here and there's so many of them. And this is important, I promise, because you might just be saying, wow, this is a lot of conjecture to add to the story for absolutely no reason whatsoever. But it's not, because it is so rare that there was a place so safe and so popping that it made easy to get around while being very flamboyant and obvious without getting noticed. See, I don't know if you know this, but if you're a relatively flamboyant kind of fella in a sea full of very masculine men, it's pretty easy to be spotted. But if you're in a sea of queens, it's a lot harder to spot one specific crown, if you catch my drift. This is how Andrew Cunanan was evading getting caught for four murders he had committed and was running from when Gianni Versace came home after his show in Paris that July of 1997. Andrew Cunanan is a bit of a mystery, but I'd like to introduce you all to him.
I don't think I like him.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
He seems not like the protagonist of this story.
Not great.
See, Andrew was born in 1969 in National City, California, to Pete and Marianne Cunanan. Partially Filipino and Italian, Andrew was born into a diverse family as the youngest of four kids. His mother, Marianne, had a significant amount of mental health, but was able to be a stay-at-home mom, and his dad, Pete, did very well at work, doing what, I don't know, something businessy. You know, I could tell you a business word, but I don't know that it's right, and I don't want to be wrong. But he did very well, and he often picked up whatever slack Marianne couldn't pick up due to her mental health. There were times that Marianne was so unwell she literally couldn't get out of bed, and due to this, Pete would, again, he sort of became a step-in the second he got home.
Mm-hmm.
Pete and Andrew became bonded so quickly because of this, so they were just like best pals, you know? Pete taught Andrew everything about the important things in life, to him at least. That was status, money, reputation, and things.
So materialism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the family did very well, and Andrew was the baby, but also very clearly the favorite. I could hear him saying, Mom and Dad went until they hit perfection, and then they stopped. And
what a dick.
Somehow, in that family, I think they would have been like, yes, son, you're correct. See, it was very clear that he was the favorite. This included things like getting the master bedroom in the home to himself while other siblings and his parents had to share.
What?
This also included his dad buying him a car before he could even drive while he had siblings that could drive that Pete refused to let touch the car. That was Andrew's.
Do they think that they're making a good person? Like, you are making a man with such a complex who was such an ass.
They even started so
self-important.
Wait. They even started using the nickname Prince to refer to Andrew.
Stop it.
Be like, this is my brother, the Prince.
I hate that. I know whatever they like love him the most or like him the most, but like by bowing down to him, do you think you're doing him favors?
You know, I don't know that they were thinking about that.
Do they? I mean, I know they don't care, but it's just no.
I think Marianne had some other stuff she was focused on at the forefront of her depression.
Yeah, but for I also Pete think to be like, hey, he's the best. We'll all. I picture them like stacked like the fucking kids in the Charlie and the Chocolate. What's the family's?
Yeah.
The Buttons. Is that Charlie Button? Is that his name?
Oh, that's so cute. I don't know what you're talking about, but.
You never saw the names? No. Okay.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what the name is.
Okay. Sorry. You know how the grandparents are all like fucking four to a bed there? Like
Grandpa Joe's just like milking it for all it's worth.
And then Grandpa Joe can magically just get up and
dance like a whole fucking tap number.
Hike. Like he couldn't have been fucking working. Okay. but the parents are like counting their pennies, like splitting a piece of chocolate. But
yeah.
Homeboy's just waiting to cash in on a ticket. Anyway.
Brother, get into customer service.
All I'm saying is that it sounds like so they all went without so that he could go with, and there's literally no reason for that.
So I will say I'm not sure if the parents went to a smaller room that was separate from the other siblings, but it did sound like regardless, he got the master bedroom, kicked his parents out of it. I mean, they might have very willfully left, but you know,
yeah, you get the main bedroom,
and then his other siblings are sharing. Which is wild.
And they're the youngest. I feel like normally that goes by age.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wouldn't know. But yeah. So
I don't like him.
As Andrew got older, something unthinkable happened. His dad, Pete, it turned out, had not been super successful in his business, but was super successful from embezzling from a super successful business. So when he got found out, Pete sold the house out from under the family and fled to the Philippines.
Without the family.
Correct.
Okay.
If getting caught and losing everything wasn't enough, Pete just couldn't stand to see his reputation tarnished. Andrew, being close to his dad, just assumed he'd go find him in the Philippines and then they'd live together there. And he did, actually, to his credit. He followed through on that, going to the Philippines. But when he got there, he saw his father living in squalor, nearly penniless, and left.
What?
Well, he wasn't going to live like that.
Ah.
He's a prince. So.
Okay, well, your dad also did just, like, leave you. So, I mean, if that were the reason, I could understand. But then why go find him? But it's just because he doesn't live an immaculate life.
Yeah.
Which is just so beneath you.
So sometime around this transition, I've heard it both as noted being before he goes to the Philippines and after he comes back. Maybe it's both. But around this time, Andrew started meeting some sugar daddies. Okay. Or at least older men who gave him an allowance and gifts for his affection and time.
Yeah, sugar daddies.
Well, that's what I thought, but maybe that was the arrangement they both had that they liked and they had a different word. I don't know.
Do you ever just want a sugar daddy that doesn't want sugar?
Yeah, I want someone whose kink it is for me to spend the money on their credit card.
I want someone to be like, ooh, baby girl, I love it when you go to TJ Maxx.
Baby, can you please go to Prada and just max it out?
Can you send me pictures of the bags that you bought?
Yes, I can.
Like, those are the kinds of pictures I will send you.
Yes, I got you. And you know what? If you're lucky, my foot might be in it.
Maybe.
Not in the bag, just in the background of the picture. Ew, guys.
Ew.
Be real.
Calm down. Grow up. So,
I believe he had multiple streams of revenue coming in at once, if you catch my drift.
But I do.
Andrew loved this arrangement. He loved parading around his money. He loved acting like it was his and coming up with a variety of lies to share about his background, conveniently leaving out anything that even almost kind of seemed like the truth to craft up something a little more glamorous. He was someone different to everyone who met him.
He's so afraid to be him.
Mm-hmm. But Andrew, despite loving the attention and the money and the fun, clearly had some attachment wounds. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Andy, you gotta work on that, bud.
That's what your therapist is for. You can probably see them when you go get your PrEP so that you don't get HIV.
Andy.
Thanks. To say the least, you know? But I wish I could offer more in terms of who he was or how he was, but the truth is, he never told the truth. So... Mm-hmm. Anything that I've seen about him, any of the information, literally other than the FBI.gov website on this, is really mostly interviews with people who knew him saying entirely different stories about what they knew about him.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, helps us understand that none of those are probably true, or very little of them, if any. But that's all I got. That's all I can comfortably tell you happened.
Mm.
So... Ultimately, what we do know is that Andrew usually thought he had a closer relationship with someone than that person thought they had with him.
Mm-hmm.
As the years went by, he had developed a reliance on methamphetamine. So that also became a part of this.
Yes.
And then the years keep coming and they don't stop coming.
Heard that once.
Yeah. And he no longer was like this hot snatched little thing that was super young and fresh on the scene. And he was looking a little bit older for the scene, probably advanced by the methamphetamine that he was spending a lot of money on. And the sugar daddies, I mean, they didn't all stop, but the well runneth low.
Yeah.
You know? And this made Andrew incredibly depressed. And this is where we enter 1997. So we are going to talk about a couple of people soon, and very soon, that Andrew has presumably had some sort of relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know if this is a sugar daddy-esque relationship like he seemed to have with a lot of people. If this was like a, we went on two dates and we thought it was really something and then I never heard from them again. There's some history, but because we know nothing, we don't know fully what that history is.
Do we think it was romantic though? Or could it have been like friendship, camaraderie, community?
we know at least two of the people we're about to start talking about, it was romantic.
Okay.
So this is where we enter 1997. A man that Andrew has seen, and we don't know if they actively were dating, was David Madsen. Andrew was in to David Madsen. Okay. Mm. He's a cutie, and he really is. He's got like, I don't know, just like a comforting presence. If you see any videos on him that like one of his old coworkers and friends shared. And this one of the coworkers shared, I think it was on the 48 hours. I don't know. I watched a bunch of shit on this. I'll link it all, but it's in one of them. And she was like, you know, I think that Andrew was more into him than he was into Andrew because David never mentioned his name.
Ooh.
So that's like a little awkward.
Awkward. Okay.
But Andrew was really into him, okay? He was like, hey, what are we?
Mm.
Do you want a DTR? Do you want to go to dinner? Do you want to meet my parents right now?
Yes.
And David was like, hey, no. I'm moving to Minneapolis, but you're hot. But no.
Oof.
Yeah.
Yikes. And where's Andrew living now?
They are still in California.
They are. Okay.
Yes. So David goes to Minneapolis, and well, they must have remained friendly because Andrew went to visit him in April.
Okay.
And I'm just going to give a quick trigger warning here because it's going to get really fucking awful, really fucking fast. I have very little information to share with you, which is awful, on the first few murders of this spree. But I'll tell you what I got.
Mm.
So Andrew flies or drives or trains or whatever out to Minneapolis in April of 1997, where he stays with David for a bit. Allegedly, and this is a big allegedly, Andrew asked David to marry him.
Okay.
And David said, no.
No, buddy.
No, buddy. Thank you. And my guess would be that if this happened, it was likely that trigger to what comes next. Because otherwise, I'm Jon Snow. I know nothing. I have no idea what else could have prompted this if this didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say something else couldn't have, but we don't know.
Yep.
So it must have been the next day or within the next few days, because David also reached out to another friend that had moved out there. Andrew calls up this old flame, Jeffrey Trail, who had also recently moved to Minneapolis. And I believe Jeffrey was actually just out of the Navy.
Okay.
One of his close friends actually talked on the 48 hours, and it was really impactful to hear the friend's perspective of this. But Jeffrey went out to Minneapolis and he heard from Andrew that he was out there, and Andrew was like, hey, do you want to hook up while I'm in town? Because I'm in town. And Jeffrey was like, yeah, I do. Let me know. So the next day, David left, and presumably I've heard that he was walking his dog. There's a little bit of like argument as to whether or not he was actually out of the house. I believe he had to be for certain logistics to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But basically Andrew was like, hey, come over. Like, the house is mine. We can, not like he's claiming it, but like, I have the house to myself. We can fool around.
Mm-hmm.
So Jeffrey comes over. And there are one or two reports from neighbors of like hearing a verbal argument first, but then seemingly out of nowhere, after Jeffrey came to this house, Andrew Cunanan brutally murdered Jeffrey Trail on April 29th, 1997.
Why?
It was very close, very personal, and where Andrew had beat Jeffrey to death with a hammer.
Oh.
Some people believe this was in front of David Madsen, and others believe that he was out of the house. I personally think he was out of the house. But eventually, Madsen also wasn't coming around to work. So one of his coworkers got worried that he wasn't seen and went to his house, and they actually discovered this scene. They walked in on this.
Oh, no.
Jeffrey Trail had been rolled up in a rug and sort of left there, and nobody else was there. So Andrew and David were gone. We don't know.
That sounds like the Wade Wilson case, the Deadpool killer
we
covered a while back, with just the odd, like, gruesome scene, roll somebody up in a carpet and leave it.
Yep.
I don't know why that just stands out to me. That is so odd.
It's really strange.
Because it's like, are you trying to cover it up? But you did not really try.
Like, you were like, here, I'll make it easier for you to discover this thing, but I'm not going to not do it, and I'm not going to help.
It's just...
Yeah.
Why bother then? But okay.
So relief was only very temporarily provided to this friend because they learned that the body in David's home wasn't David.
Right.
This was Jeffrey Traill. It was a man they didn't know.
Which is odd because you're like, where's my friend? Did he do this?
Right. And why is this man in his house and my friend still hasn't been seen or heard from?
Yeah.
So soon after, David Madsen's body, though, was found on the east shore of Rush Lake near Rush City, Minnesota. Authorities believe that David was held hostage for a few days with Andrew. Some people think they might have done this together, but I have literally no reason to suspect that of David. And as we see, Andrew does this more than once, so I have every reason to suspect that it was Andrew. There were a few eyewitness accounts of them being together, like in an elevator or out and about. And so I think that it was probably like a, you're going to do what I tell you to do kind of thing. And we know, too, that David Madsen was killed as a result of multiple shots into the head that were made with a .40 caliber semi-automatic rifle that, get this, Andrew stole from Jeffrey Traill, their first victim, after he murdered him.
What a bitch.
Yeah, literally. So Andrew was on the run. His crimes were being discovered, and while there is speculation as to whether or not he liked that, there weren't any license plate scanners that connected to photographs. There were no, you know, easy passes on the highway or sunshine passes to take a photo of your car to show the person driving it. So he got a head start and he kept that head start for a long time.
Could you imagine being those friends who you go in, you find this gruesome scene. You think it's your friend. You're panicked.
Mm-hmm.
Find out it isn't. Then later just to find out your friend's dead anyway. Like that roller coaster of emotions, yeah. That whiplash you would feel as the family and friends, like the loved ones of these people is like, what the hell?
Yeah.
I can't imagine. That's just too much.
It also just, and this is, again, speculation. I don't know a lot about either of their families. I don't know about whether or not David or Jeffrey were like accepted. But I thought it was really notable that the people talking about them in these like heavy true crime documentaries, like interviews with ABC, it wasn't their families.
Mm-hmm.
It was a friend or a coworker. Like, you think of other victim types and it's like, oh, my baby, she's gone. And it's like a mom sobbing into 48 hours or an aunt or an uncle.
Right.
But for a lot of people at this time, their family was their friends. It was the people that they chose.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It just always struck me. I was like, but where's their mom? Like,
I know. I always wonder with those two, because if it's around the time it happened, you expect to see that. But if this is 30 years later that they're talking about it, some of those people might have been passed.
Right.
Or just not well enough or not wanting to rehash that after that time. But I always wonder that too. Where are the...
Yeah.
Where's the family?
Especially when it's multiple people. Like, yep. It's not like it's one thing if it's one person, but when there's like a few victim types the same, that I'm always just like, oh.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Did you only film it in this one spot and it was only the people that lived there and everyone else has since moved? Like, what was the process of that?
So, anyway, there's no photography on the highways. There's nothing to electronically alert anyone as he drove across the country. There's not even like a cell phone in his hand to ping. You know? So he's just driving. And Andrew made up his mind to hit another family, but only wanted to do so in order to like rest somewhere, freshen up. You know, he didn't want to look like swassy. Probably.
So he wanted to kill somebody else because he didn't want to be grimy?
It's possible that he was looking to break in and not kill anyone, but he certainly had no qualms when it came to adding another victim to his numbers. I'll put it that way.
Ugh.
This is as he was driving through Chicago, Illinois, where he was scoping a house before seeing another house with a single older man named Lee Miglin, who was in his 70s waiting for his wife to come home from a trip. Lee was actually an incredibly successful, I think he was a lawyer or something in the legal field. He had quite a bit of money. I think Andrew saw the house and was like, yeah, that could do. That's my guess.
That's awful.
But also, he was a single older man instead of a couple or a family or something that he might have to, I don't know, not deal with, you know? And so this is the only victim that is really confusing. I'll say that. Like, at least with Jeffrey and David, we know that there was a history there of some kind.
Yep.
And likely whatever happened was the anger was sort of spurred in rejection, is sort of what I speculate.
He seems to be the type.
He seems to be the type. Lee Miglin is the only person that we have no clue on. He was married. He was married to a woman, but he lived near Chicago, which is a place where there would have been probably a community of people if he was interested in experimenting. And while I don't know if Andrew had ever been there specifically before, that's not to say that he wasn't or that Lee couldn't have traveled and ran into him somewhere. But also Lee was married to a woman. But what really makes it hard for me to say, like, typically I'd say, okay, there's nothing to say they're connected. But the killing here that happens is so brutal. They almost have to be in some way. I mean, I don't know. That's speculation. But on May 3rd of 1997, so this is just a day after David Madsen's discovery, Andrew bound Lee's hands and feet, wrapped his head with duct tape, and then stabbed him more than 20 times with a screwdriver, and then slit his throat with a hacksaw and stole his car.
Not necessary. Yeah, it's definitely overkill. And
yeah.
Okay. I mean, I can understand, like, I don't know if he's still using drugs at this time, like, if that can mess with your brain, obviously.
That's a good point.
I could consider that. If he's using meth and he's not sleeping or he's coming down, there's a whole slew of things that can be going on. He could just be projecting some kind of frustration or anger on him. He's still excited from the last two murders, given that there's been nearly no time in between. But
it's brutal.
It's very brutal. To me, that's rageful.
Yeah.
So if you're not mad at him, what are you mad about?
Right. And what gets me about this is that, like, obviously nobody knows for sure if there was a connection. I will say it sounded like some detectives that were on the case heavily implied that they believed the two knew each other. But from anything that was shared, it sounded like they only believed that because of the brutality of it.
Right, because they found any other evidence for that.
Right, and if they did, it just wasn't made clear to me. It didn't sound like that. But I do get it. I mean, it's hard to think about doing that to a random person. But if that's not enough, like, if that is literally not enough, Andrew robbed the home of several things, including gold coins, jewelry, fucking Lee's clothing.
But you duct taped the man?
Mm-hmm.
You could have just left. You could have still gotten all of the material things you're very clearly after and left him alive. So why brutally kill him? You could have blindfolded him, duct taped him, and left him.
Yep.
And still done all of the things that allow you to benefit financially from this, which is, let's be honest, seems like a big part of his identity is having stuff.
Yeah.
That you didn't have to kill the man to do that.
Correct. Also, I'd like to remind everybody, he has a fucking 40 caliber semi-automatic. He didn't need to stab the man 20 times with a screwdriver.
Well, he does need to keep it quiet.
Fair. But if that wasn't enough, and if the robbery didn't add to it all, Andrew stayed a while.
But his wife's coming home.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Andrew knew that. He stayed long enough to eat some ice cream. He had some ham. He shaved. And I believe he actually even checked the voicemail machine on the phone, which is how he learned that Lee's wife was coming home the next day. So he had less than 24 hours, which is when he then stole their car and left with the car.
That poor guy.
And his poor wife, because Lee was discovered by his wife, who was confused after having to take a cab home when her husband didn't show up for her at the airport for the first time in their marriage.
What do you think goes through your mind during that? Because you're probably calling and at first you're pissed.
Yeah.
You're like, I am just getting home. Do you not want to be dealing with this? I don't want to take a cab home. If you could please come get me. Did you oversleep? Like, what's going on? And then maybe you get even more frustrated. You're like, are you kidding me? I am still here at the airport.
Yeah.
And then I imagine panic hits.
Yeah.
Where you're like, no, this is too long to not be able to reach you.
Yeah.
What happened? This isn't like you. Then you start going through that kind of thing. And maybe it's just because I'm a card-carrying member of the anxious girly club. But my brain would go to the worst.
Yeah.
That's what I do. But can you imagine that cab ride? How hellacious that is. And then to get into your home,
your car's missing.
Worse than anything. Well, if I saw my car missing, though, I might think, oh no, is he on his way to go get me and now I missed him and he's gonna get to the airport at the time that I get home, and now it's a whole logistics thing, and that's frustrating, but at least he's okay.
Yeah.
And then you get in the house, the car's missing, but he is not okay,
and he is there.
Ugh.
But because she was lovely and helped so much, police were able to identify that their car was stolen, have people on the lookout for that specific license plate, car, etc. But also, because she was the fucking best, they also learned that there was a car phone in the stolen car, which did ping to cell towers. So they could start tracing that. Again, it's the 90s. Everything was a lot more delayed. So we're talking, you know, backed up a few, but they at least have an idea of a path that he's on, right? And so at this point, Andrew, he be known, right? Like, they know that it's him. They've seen these two murders that happened in Minneapolis with David and Jeffrey. They were able to say, hey, he said something about his friend Andrew coming into town. Then this happens here. A guy's car is stolen. And they say, okay, like, it might be the same guy.
Yeah, they're kind of piecing it together.
Yes. And then, because, you know, it's the 90s and people are a little bit slow, Andrew is still ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But he makes a little detour. People seem to think that he was going to Florida specifically. I think he was taking his time. I think he knew there was no life of normalcy after this. So he was kind of like making an extended vacation, if you will. So instead of going down south, which I'm not sure why people think that was the specific trajectory. I don't think it's like he got close and then made a hard left.
Mm-hmm.
He goes up to New Jersey.
Okay.
Maybe he wanted to go through New York. I don't know.
Yeah.
And honestly, if he did, I'm sure there are probably more people we don't know about. But he goes to New Jersey. And of course, Andrew knows that the car is being tracked. He knows that they're onto him. The police still have like a public radio, not radio, but like a public walkie line you could listen in on anytime, you know?
Yeah.
So he knows what's happening. So he's like, all right, I got to get got with this car. Like, I got to ditch the car. Which is when he finds his fourth victim, who is pretty much known as the only truly transactional victim that we can say for certain.
Okay.
Who is William Reese. William Reese, unfortunately, ran into Andrew Cunanan on May 9th of 1997, about a week after the others. He was a groundskeeper for a cemetery in Pennsville Township, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
While it is known that there were sexual or romantic relationships with both Jeffrey and David, and it's unknown but speculated it might have been with Lee, William Reese was truly only murdered because Andrew Cunanan wanted his fucking red pickup truck. He shot him with that same rifle, and then he took his pickup truck.
Just throw the guy out of the car.
Yeah.
At gunpoint. Traumatize him, but let him live. But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, that's...
It's better than the alternative.
But it's like, you can still get the car. You don't have to kill the man. He is scared.
Yeah.
He knows he's not going to do anything about it.
Yep.
Order him to get out and take it. And then maybe they don't catch on to you so quick.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's definitely less of a trail if you're not leaving bodies behind you.
Like, they already know they're looking for you. It's not like killing the guy because he knows your face. They know your face, man. They know who you are.
Yeah.
Oy.
And what's fascinating here is that typically when we talk about spree killers, it's pretty much what he's been doing, right? It's like kind of one after another. There's like this period almost of like specific killings.
Mm-hmm.
And not, it doesn't have to be specific as in like the specific person, but just like, this is what I'm doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
I am killing right now.
Today? Yeah, I am. I am doing that.
And while that is a typical spree killer, Andrew is not. Because from here, it goes quiet for a bit. With 4 murders in just about 2 weeks, there was then nothing for months.
Seriously?
Seriously. At least nothing that was connected to him. Andrew Cunanan landed himself on the FBI's top 10 most wanted list, got himself an episode of America's Most Wanted, and continued his journey down to Miami Beach in Florida.
Nice.
Yeah. David had been hiding out, staying in the Normandy Plaza Hotel and hiding in plain sight for time, which is why all of that culture came in handy, because this man is so flamboyant. But you know what? So is fucking everyone in South Beach, Florida. With due respect, if you're not, you're not. But you know what I mean? Like, there's enough of it there that they're not like, oh, a singular gay man.
Yeah.
You know, so he just hung out. He talked to people. He gave them his real name.
He's granted, just chilling.
He never fucking gave them any truth about anything else about him, but he gave him his name.
Mm-hmm.
People who saw the America's Most Wanted thought they saw him and called in tips after that.
Good for them. So people actually in South Beach called?
There were a few.
Well, they're probably from all over because everybody
right
will call, but okay.
And the FBI knew enough that he might be in the Miami area,
mm-hmm.
so police departments were warned. And police departments then did the right thing and started warning the communities. And I will say, there was a little bit of a moment where it seemed like they were explicitly leaving out that he had murdered people that were also gay and that he himself was gay. And I've heard different reasons for that. Some people say that it was like trying to be sensitive, but then being like, well, this might actually tip off people who need to be safer, like mm-hmm. who need to do something to protect themselves. And they started saying it later. So I don't know when exactly that specific part of this information became public knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point while he was in Florida between May and July, this did come out. So now South Beach, who's like, again, I'm just going to remind us all, we're in the height of the fucking AIDS epidemic. People are just now getting meds. People are like out and proud and mostly okay to be outside without worrying too much about being jailed for being gay, which was a crime at this time in many places. But also, now there's a fucking serial killer on the loose who's a queer man who's probably hunting you.
And he looks just like you.
So, have fun.
Oh, no.
So they're all fucking panicked, because of course they are.
Yeah, but they need to know. Right. They need to be able to save themselves, make their own decisions, informed decisions.
Informed consent is very important in every area of life.
It is.
And so this is the South Beach that Gianni Versace couldn't have known was the one he was returning to after his Paris runway in 1997. Gianni had returned with Antonio that July, just a few days before. And Andrew, having been hiding in plain sight for months at this point, was in the hotel around town. I mean, he even sold the stolen gold coin from Lee Miglin's house to a pawn shop. where he used his real name. And then he had to sign a contract to say that it was his and that he could sell it, that the pawn shop was then legally obligated to provide to the police. So his name and signature was sitting on their desk, but they were all so busy looking for him that nobody was going through the papers from the pawn shop.
Oh my God.
Or if they were, they didn't know, but I'm assuming they probably just had so many people and they were like, hey, you know, the murderer takes precedence.
We're trying to catch the serial killer. No, we don't have time to look through the pawn shop logs.
Right. Right.
So, and I wonder, like, if they did see it. I don't know what the rules would have been at the time. Now you have to show an ID for everything, and it's ridiculous. But I feel if you could just give a fake name, how many people would be assholes and just, like, put his name down because they know? You know what I mean? It's like putting, like, Ted Bundy down. You know, yeah, I'm Ted Bundy. You know what I'm saying? Like, that kind of thing. Like, I even wonder if they would, I don't know the logistics of that, but, like, there's always one.
Yeah.
Just like those unsolved, there's always something. Yeah, I think I saw him. It was at Ben Dover's house.
Was that Seymour Butts? Yeah. So, yeah, just kind of crazy that all of this is happening. But obviously, like, they only have so many resources, and there was no automated system to raise an alarm. It's not like they were scanning it over and it said, hey, we know this name.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was just nothing.
Yeah, it's all pen and paper.
So on the day of July 15th, 1997, Gianni Versace got up early to go get coffee and his magazines from the newsstand out front, like he did every morning.
Yeah.
The only difference on this day was that he got up a little extra early, so Antonio didn't go with him. He let Antonio sleep in. So he went, he got the magazines, he got the coffee, and he went back to the home, or the chateau, if you will. And he didn't know he was being followed, but Gianni was targeted and shot on the front steps of his home at 8:45 a.m. And Antonio heard the entire thing.
Oh, that is terrifying.
There was a witness who was on 48 hours, who said they were friends. I've heard that they were neighbors. They could have been both. It could have been another stranger. I don't know. But this person actually was in a pursuit with Cunanan. He heard the shooting and he started to chase him.
Wow.
And Cunanan actually fled into a nearby parking garage where the red truck that was William Reese's was parked.
Mm.
He quickly changed clothes. And then he walked out like nothing happened. Versace was pronounced dead at Jackson Memorial Hospital at 9:21 a.m. And responding police did find the stolen vehicle and clothes outside of it. And clippings actually of newspaper reports about the earlier murders right around the truck. So I think he must have literally had the clothes like folded next to the truck. I don't think he even had to open a door.
Oh my God. And it's like he had like all the clippings for like his vision board.
Yep. He said, I would have loved Pinterest. I actually came up with it before you guys did.
So this is odd to me though, because it seems like everybody else he's killed, he has financially benefited from this, right? Mm-hmm. And the root of this is the materialism. He's an asshole. Like it's just, it's all about that and appearances. And he has been able to benefit. He got the car. He got the gold coins. He's like stolen from people, or he's had like a personal issue with them. Boyfriend right. doesn't like you back or whatever.
Yeah.
But this is just shooting a man on his front steps.
Yes.
Why?
Well, it's a great question. And we're going to get there. Kind of. But ultimately, we also need to remember that it's not just a man. This is the man that in my head, I think Andrew really wanted to be. This was Gianni Versace. He came from nothing. He built an empire. This is a family-owned business. They are Italian. He's part Italian. He has all of the clothes, all of the money. There's supermodels hanging off of his arm everywhere you turn. And he's had one partner that loves him for 15 years.
So he embodies everything he wanted.
That's my guess.
But and he had all the material things. He had the beautiful home and
Reciprocated love and gold.
Yep.
And also really nice shoes.
Yeah, that too. It matters.
But 8 days later, on July 23rd, 1997, the police were called to a nearby luxury houseboat after hearing a gunshot. Someone actually, they said it was a caretaker, but I think it was like they were the caretaker of the boat. So I think they could have been like a cleaner or some sort of like grounds faculty in some way for these houseboats.
Yeah, if there's heard like it. A marina, yeah, staff would, yeah.
Makes yeah, sense. So they heard it and they called the police and the police were like, well, shit, because Andrew Cunanan, known serial killer who shot fucking Gianni Versace in front of his house, is on the loose and we're going to go. But it might be like an active pursuit with this guy because mm-hmm. he's the only one that we know of right now that has reason to be like shooting people that we know of that has mm-hmm. and could again. And luckily they did come. The housekeeper or caretaker was totally fine, but it wasn't a shot of anybody else, but actually they just walked in on to find the body of Andrew Cunanan, who had shot himself in the head with the same stolen weapon from Jeffrey Trail, which killed David Madsen, William Reese, and Gianni Versace.
So was Versace the end goal?
I think so.
Jeez.
Also, a super fucking weird fun fact that Wikipedia told me on my first read through of this is that Cunanan's cremated remains are at a mausoleum in San Diego.
Oh.
I said, that's fucking weird. I'm going to put that in there. Cause what? But anyway, just so you know. But ultimately, Andrew didn't leave a suicide note.
Yep.
He never explained or gave any clues as to why he did the things he did.
So we can just speculate.
And people sure have.
Yeah.
People say that he met Versace like 7 years ago. Some people believe they met like once at a party and that either Versace rejected him or that he more likely was probably kind at like an arm's length, some sort of like performative politeness.
Mm-hmm.
And either that was taken as rejection or that Andrew then believed that he was much closer with Versace, that this is my close friend Gianni. Because he did have a history of thinking he was closer with people than he was.
Well, being closer with than you are or being unknown to them are very different things.
Yes. But people seem to speculate, and again, I'm going to say speculate because I don't have any fucking clue, that this was like the initial meeting and then sometime later they ran into each other again and either Andrew was like sort of blocked out by the posse around Gianni or Gianni didn't remember him. Because why would he? He meets 1 billion people who adore him everywhere he goes,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. So, like, I think that's an option that could have been a portrayed rejection. It could have also just been truly, like, a manifestation of everything he wanted that he believed Gianni Versace was, and he had access. Yep. This is a man in South Beach. I know where he is. He's unprotected.
Yeah.
But some people also speculate that Andrew had AIDS and was actually killing anyone he slept with up until William Reese.
But even that, what?
Right.
Believing that he contracted it from one of them out of anger or
we're not sure either.
Predetermining their death. That is.
We're not sure, but I will say I don't hold a lot of weight in this. Is it possible that he believed it? Maybe. But he did not have AIDS when they performed the autopsy on him. So. I don't put a lot of my weight in that basket. It's not impossible. I just don't see any evidence that really points me that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It's even that, like, even if there was anything, I could understand the first two. But there's a dotted line at best between Lee. That would mean William Reese was truly just a victim of opportunity. And if you're saying that he has a very specific motive for killing people, it would be weird for him to break that. For a car.
Mm-hmm.
And then to go to Gianni Versace. I mean, I'm not saying that Gianni was an angel. I don't know. I mean, he was in the realm of fashion. Like, everywhere you are, there's, like, Coke and models and super artsies everywhere. Like,
yeah.
That is a world of glamour and fashion. I don't know what he got into. But it sounded like he got into a cab and went home to Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
So much that people were like, ugh, go home early again.
Like, yeah. Go home to your happy husband.
Boo. Yeah, like that's what it sounded like. So I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it doesn't seem very likely that there would have been any sexual relation between the two of them.
Yeah, doesn't seem like it.
And so then the only other thing I have left to think is that this has to be some sort of perceived social rejection, or it was like, you are everything I wanted to be and I'll never be. Or yeah. I want to take some of the fame from killing you, because then at least people will know my name. Which, joke's on you, because I love true crime and I didn't even know it until now.
Same. So take that.
Yeah.
Stick that in your juice box and suck it.
But just as a little wrap up, because that's literally all the information there is on Andrew. It's terrifying and sad and deeply depressing. At least we can follow up with a few really good pieces of news from Versace, or the House of Versace, if you will. First, though it was a bit of a drama, Gianni had actually secretly changed his will relatively recently. He gave like a stipend of, I think, like literally $50 million a year or a month or something to Antonio.
Okay.
And then.
That's so much.
He left literally everything.
To his niece.
To his niece Allegra.
I knew it.
Yes. Bless up. Donatella, queen, badass bitch, struggled for a hot minute. For like 7 years, she really squalored in like substance use and really was depressed. I mean, it was like her very best friend and like the heart of their family business and dream had died.
Mm-hmm.
Very traumatically, and had cut her out of the will entirely, leaving her no part of the business she worked equally as hard for.
Oof.
Yes. Which, it was the same with Santo. Like, Santo didn't get anything either.
But it was all in his name. Like, he had ownership of all of it.
Yeah. Ooh. And now Allegra did. At the time, his 11-year-old niece.
No.
Yes. I'm sure he wasn't expecting it to go to his 11-year-old niece.
No, he probably thought it'd be a lot.
Yes.
Much, much later, and everybody would be so much older.
Yeah.
Maybe his siblings wouldn't want it, and it could go rightfully to Allegra in her 50s.
Right. And so that obviously was a terrible plight on their family. It was really dark. Donatella struggled quite a bit trying to replicate Gianni's style. But after she later got sober, Allegra turned 18, took over her shares, said, "Mom, you're going to rehab." She did. She came back with her own design line that did phenomenally. And Versace still stands with glamour.
Okay, so that's a...
Which we love.
I want to say a happy ending, but it's not, because it doesn't fix what happened before. But it's a good sort of redemption underdog. A good
rebound.
For Donatella. Okay.
Also, she was their vice president and, like, I think design executor until literally this year. She stepped aside in March.
Damn.
She's a boss.
How old is she?
I believe 70s.
Okay.
Or just about. And Allegra is... so hot, just in vibe. I mean, she doesn't want any of it. She literally is still like on the director council, and she's like, "I'm good. I don't need to be in this. I'm good." But beautiful, and you still know Versace, and you probably didn't know Andrew Cunanan's name at all.
No.
So, well, this is not a happy story, because no murder is, and these are real people's lives who really had devastating effects. Mm-hmm. I thought this was pretty fitting for the last Pride Month case.
Yes.
Yes.
And how awful that all of those, the loved ones of all of those people and all of those people had to deal with that, because it's so random, so unpredictable, so sudden. Like, to be the guy at the car, that's the one that like gets me, because it's just so like, had you stopped at a different light or had you taken a different turn, this wouldn't have happened.
Right.
You know what I mean? It doesn't make it okay. I don't rationalize it by any means with the other people, because obviously there was no reason for that. But there is a dotted line where I can see how they connect, where somebody who is unwell is going to can do things that are unwell and do that to the people that they know.
Right.
But this was like, had he stopped to get gas on his way to work instead of planning on doing it on his way home,
mm-hmm.
could it have changed the trajectory of things for that particular person? Now, it would have right. been somebody else.
And something that really stuck out to me was in the 48 hours where Jeffrey Traill, the first victim
mm-hmm.
who was coming out of the Navy, his good friend that was speaking on it was like, you know, now it's weird. You're always forever connected to these other people you have nothing to do with.
Yep. You never met.
You never met. He is undoubtedly intertwined with all of the other victims of this case, including Gianni Versace, of all people. And yeah. also a completely understandable serial killer. So just really interesting. If I may, as your local queer, go watch something good, you know, watch Sex in the City. Watch The Devil Wears Prada. Actually, if you're going to watch anything, watch The Devil Wears Prada. I've been craving it lately, and I'm actually reading the book, so I'm refusing to watch it before I'm done with the book.
Are you
but
really?
There is nothing like Meryl Streep being a raging bitch in Manolos.
Oh, you guys. Well, thank you for going on this ride with us. Abby, yes. thank you for bringing this to us. I have not heard of these things, and I'm so happy that I finally do, because it makes me want to look into it more. I completely thought this was related to Gucci. It shows you how much I know about fashion. I know absolutely nothing. Again, TJ Maxx, sponsor me. But we thank you all for hanging out with us.
Yes.
In our little corner of the true crime world. And if you like what you heard from us today and you've liked what you've heard before, we're totally biased, but we think yes. that you should rate us 5 stars.
Please.
Tell a friend, share. Send us an email, send us a message, send your pod pets, because we love that.
Ugh,
shit.
Please.
And we hope to see you next time.
Yeah. If you wanted to see the people, the places, the things, or anything that we're talking about today, you can do that at our Instagram, which is linked below in our link tree, where you could also, I don't know, kill an hour looking at memes. Maybe once you start scrolling, you'd be like, oh my gosh, I just have to look at Versace now. And listen to Tim Gunn talk about Versace's legacy on the fashion industry. Who
maybe,
knows?
Maybe you do. Maybe you do need to
maybe
hear
you
that.
Do and you'll make it work. But that was the worst Tim Gunn impression, no, but that is totally fine.
I don't think so. I love him.
So maybe you lose an hour there. Maybe you lose two on our Instagram. Who knows? But either way, you have a lot of Googling to do, including whatever that acronym is for HAART. I have no idea what those medical words are.
Yeah.
But happy Pride. Be out. Be you. Be safe. Be safe. Oh, my God. All right. In the meantime, I'm going to look at my watch, because that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye, guys.